Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Tonight, we are asking you questions like, are there aliens out there waiting to detect some indication that we Earth people have advanced to a stage where we are ready to join them in a galactic federation? Is humankind bound to live on multiple planets in the future? Well, engineer Dr. Mark Carlotto is our guest, and he is applying his 40 years of experience in satellite imaging and pattern recognition to answer these questions. The search for evidence of intelligent life beyond Earth or SETI has been going on, well, about 60 years, but still no extraterrestrial signal of intelligent origin has been reported. Over this same 60-year period, thousands of UFO sightings have been reported. The lack of government transparency on UFOs until recently has led many to believe in cover-ups and conspiracies to keep their existence from the public. In his new book called Not of This World, An Emerging Picture of the UFO Phenomenon, independent researcher Mark Carlotto examines the most compelling UFO cases on record, including the Gulf Breeze sightings, space shuttle videos, videos of crop circles and UFOs, Tic Tacs, and other UAP or unexplained aerial phenomena. Dr. Mark Carlotto is an engineer, scientist, and author with 40 years experience, as we've already said, in satellite imaging, remote sensing, image processing, and pattern recognition. He received his PhD or his FUD in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon University in 1981. By the way, that's the same year I received my PhD, and has written over 100 technical papers and 8 books. Outside of his occupation as an engineer in the aerospace industry, his journey as an independent scientist has taken him to Mars and back by way of planetary mysteries, local history, archaeology, and most recently, ancient origins and UFOs. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Mark.
Thanks, Dr. Bob. How are you?
My pitching arm's pretty good. How about yours?
Yeah, the Red Sox are pitching is better than we expected.
Well, that's not so good for us Orioles down here.
I know, but you beat us the first 3 games.
And then we do that a lot, but then all of a sudden we end up in another place. Anyway, yeah. Well, when we first talked in the 90s, you were studying the anomalies on Mars, that is the face and et cetera. How did you get involved in UFO research?
Well, you know, when my interest in the face was pure curiosity. And I tried to gather some data. I did analysis. I wrote a paper based on my work, and I figured, you know, that would be it. Then what I soon realized is there's more to this arena than that. There's interviews, and you end up meeting people that are not directly related to what you did, but there's some connections, and you start networking and so forth. And I started getting involved and getting interested in the UFO phenomenon from someone actually that is in the area, Dr. Bruce McAbee.
Oh, Bruce. Yes.
Yeah. Bruce had been looking at the Gulf Breeze UFO case, mm-hmm. which is an extraordinary case.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of images that he thought he had an opinion. He had already written his report, but he said, I just want to get a second opinion, what you thought. And these were some images taken with a Polaroid camera, an Instamatic, that, in his view, it'd be very hard to fake them. And even if you did, there were some problems with that theory. He believed they were authentic. And I did very little, really. Bruce's analysis was incredible. He very, very comprehensive. But what I was able to confirm was that there were no telltale signs in the images of any kind of tampering or double exposure. I talk about that a little bit in Not of This World. And that was that's kind of how I got started. But it was very short-lived, because it was really not something, at the time it wasn't really, I didn't feel like it was part of my DNA. I wasn't, I'm not really naturally skeptical. Bruce is very, skeptical, healthy amount of skepticism, right? As, as early UFO investigators had to be, because, so much of these early sightings, many of them were faked. And even today, there's so many hoaxes. That wasn't my nature. My nature was to kind of take the data at face value and then try to understand, okay, if this is real, apply some simple physical models and see what we could learn from it. And I did that, and then I kind of moved on. I've seen Bruce over the years from time to time, but I thought that was it. I thought I was done, and I kind of went back to Mars.
Well, okay. But the thing I was so fascinated about is the face on Mars. Have we ever come to any kind of conclusion other than what we were told by NASA in the beginning, and then later on they changed a bit of that? Richard Hoagland basically says that China has definitely landed there and taken a photograph of the face. Do you know anything about that? Is there any credibility in that?
With Dick, you never know.
Well, that's the reason why I got to ask. I mean, he gets mad at me an awful lot. I mean,
he always has some very interesting sources and some very interesting ideas. He's a real controversial individual. But I have to agree with Dick and Vince DiPietro and others that that have been on the show that have supported this research over the years. I think it's pretty solid evidence that that at least the face is an artificially constructed structure, that it's not a natural formation. At the time we proposed and did some analysis suggesting that some pre-existing landforms had been altered, but very deliberately altered to be, to have that face-like appearance. And, all these years later, I still hold to that, even with all this other imagery that's come out. Some of the early stuff in the late 90s that, quote-unquote, disproved, the face, according to NASA, actually provided some pretty strong evidence supporting our hypothesis.
Yeah.
And more recent imagery, I think, goes back and is actually, much better. There's some images that are, in fact, I've done some analysis on some of them using shape and shading and perspective mapping and so mm-hmm. forth, and it looks even more face-like. So I think, it's held up, and I think at least the face is an artificially constructed feature. Who did it? That's a whole other conversation.
Who did it? Do you know yet?
Well, so you know, not there. Everything is kind of connected, and in my new book, Not of This World, there are connections to the Mars research, and in particular, the whole question of there's four possibilities. Okay, the face could be a natural formation, so no big deal. Or if it is artificial, it could have been built either by native Martians and indigenous civilization that developed there, or by extraterrestrials, or by ancient aliens from Earth, let's call them. Mm-hmm. And NASA is very, very, very much against the idea of an advanced civilization in the form of visitors, extraterrestrial spacecraft, and so forth, and extraterrestrial archaeology. That's totally out of the question for them. So, as far as NASA is concerned, there's no way aliens could have constructed a face on Mars, because, hey, UFOs don't exist. So if UFOs don't exist, how could there be a face on Mars? They also are clear that Mars didn't have conditions suitable for life to have developed. Wasn't Earth-like long enough. Early on it was. Early on it had an atmosphere and water, but as over time, it lost that, and most would say it didn't exist in a suitable state long enough for any kind of indigenous life to develop, evolve to create, something like the face. So then that's the case. We're only left with one possibility: is it was built by ancient aliens from Earth, and so that's kind of where I'm at right now. We could talk about that more if you want, but that actually gets more into my, we talked a few months ago about Before Atlantis, which was my a parallel research I'm doing on ancient civilizations.
The reason why I focus on this is that I did an art piece. I'm an artist, and I did a piece for a dear friend of mine, Sir George Martin, of the Beatles,
right.
We worked together for a while, and on it I put the Mars face and the other little pyramids that are sitting around there, and I'm just getting ready to let people know about that again, posting it somewhere else, and I've heard from Hoagland that supposedly China's been there, photographed it, and it's okay. And so I didn't want to necessarily post this if I didn't think it was real. But I've always thought it was real. But anyway, so now I won't be embarrassed. And if they yell at me, I'll just say, it's your fault. Okay?
Yeah, okay. No, okay. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, it's definitely there.
Yeah.
It's been imaged a number of times, right? So it's not like, a photo. It's not like an artifact or a piece of lint on the film or something like that. It's it's some of the you probably talked to researchers over the years about some of the lunar anomalies, early claims from Apollo and lunar orbiter back in the 60s that some of pictures showed towers and glass structures on the moon. A lot of those I believe are artifacts or film defects and scratches and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. But I mean the face is quite large, and it's been imaged a number of times, and it's it's there. What it is still TBD. Yeah. I don't think we have to I don't think we have to take China's word. I think Elon Musk will get us there in a few years, and we'll find out for ourselves.
Well,
I have to believe he's curious enough that even if NASA isn't too keen on him going there, he'll be he'll prevail and have an expedition to Cydonia to determine, if it's artificial or not.
I'm sorry, but I got to ask this other question here. What about helium-3? Is it what China is talking about? All the emphasis they're putting on helium-3 for power in the future?
Well, that's on the moon, right?
Moon, yes, yes.
Yeah.
But we can put it on Mars too.
I guess there's enough of it on the moon to make it worthwhile. You've probably talked to John Brandenburg. John probably knows more about that than I do.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, we got break time here on 21st Century Radio. When we come back, we're going to ask you an important question, such as how do you approach the study of UFOs? Will you straighten that out for us?
I'll try.
Good going. All right. All right. Back to our show here on 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Mark Carlotto. How do you approach the study of UFOs, and are you a skeptic?
I would say it's probably not very top down. It's probably not very analytical necessarily initially. I think there's a perhaps it's an intuition. You know, nowadays there's so many reports. There's so much information out there. You look at the source. You look at where it's appearing. You look at the claim. You look at the phenomenon itself. And then I think there are some that sort of grabbed me. I think probably the one that I was most taken by when I was writing the book was the Jerusalem UFO sightings back in 2011. It was just something extraordinary about them, and they just never seemed to have made it to the mainstream, to the major media outlets, that at least that I could recall. So I think my approach is probably a little bit less analytical in the beginning, but then as I start getting obsessed with it, my wife would say, I think I become very particular about, you know, the data, things matching up. And, you know, for me to say that, you know, I think something is extraordinary, I have to have some data behind it. It's at that point, it's not a feeling. You know, I think intuition kind of gets the process going. And half the time it's like, you know, this is a waste of time. This isn't going anywhere. There's nothing here. Or the data doesn't exist to support the hypothesis or the claim. But for those that, you know, you start looking at it more closely and it looks even more extraordinary, those are the ones that I will really latch onto. And if I, you know, come to a conclusion that I think it's, legitimate, I want to have some physical model, some evidence, something, you know, tangible to back it up. So it's kind of a left brain, sort of a little bit of left brain, right brain approach, I would say.
That's a good balance. I think that's the way to do it. In my opinion, I'm biased, though.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm an engineer, and I think a lot of people think that there's a lack of, creative thought in engineering. You know, a lot of engineering is sort of making things faster. Nowadays, you know, smarter if you're in information technology, cheaper, whatever. There's the optimization part of engineering, but then there's the, you know, the initial ideas stage, which is what I've always been interested in. What I do is, you know, come up with some new approaches, and you know, that aspect of engineering can be very creative.
Yeah, I bet.
So it's a little of both.
Thank you. Well, tell us about the UFOs captured by cameras aboard the space shuttle in the 1990s. Why are these videos important?
So after I spent a little bit of time working with Bruce Maccabee, I went back to the Mars investigation, and you know, Richard Hoagland and I worked to. I'll use the term, loosely, that we worked together. I mean, Dick would call me and suggest I look at this or look at that. And it went from Mars to lunar anomalies, and then to a video taken by the space shuttle, STS-48. And I didn't realize it at the time, but like the face on Mars, Vince DiPietro was there in the very beginning. He was actually at NASA Goddard when the live feed came over the TV, and he, you know, noticed something really weird going on the NASA Select TV monitor at Goddard. And he he was curious and he pursued it right off the bat. And I didn't find out about it for probably 6 months after Vince had done his report. And you know, news didn't travel as fast back then.
It sure didn't.
Dick Hoagland got me interested in the STS-48 and got me some videos to analyze. And it was quite interesting because the video came from NASA. It had a certain cachet. You know, it wasn't like someone had just taken this with their own camera. But the fact that it came from a U.S. spacecraft meant the integrity of the data was beyond question. Mm-hmm. And my company actually let me use some equipment to analyze it, you know, provided I do it off hours. So, you know, after hours, I was free to use the video equipment to analyze the data. And I wrote up analysis I had to publish in the Journal of Scientific Exploration, basically supporting Vince's claim and Dick Hoagland and others who saw the video as evidence of some sort of aerospace technology that that wasn't ours. It was beyond our current capabilities. Mm-hmm. I published that, and you know, it was like the Base on Mars investigation. The NASA response was, you know, in this case, it, you know, it's ice particles, and it was a prosaic, you know, mm-hmm. commonplace explanation, just, you know, unusual data or data that people aren't used to, or images, videos people aren't used to looking at being seen in unusual ways. And so people are concluding that unusual things are going on, but in fact, it's all quite usual and normal and commonplace, and there's nothing to get, you know, excited about. So that it was sort of like round two with NASA, again, an opportunity to perhaps would have been an opportunity for them to maybe been a little bit more transparent, conducted maybe more of a open investigation. But like the Mars investigation, all the analysis took place outside of NASA. So, you know, it was extraordinary because of the integrity of the data. You really could not dispute the source that, you know, someone certainly did not fake the video. And then a few years later, I analyzed another video from STS-80, which was even more unusual, you know, where STS-48 showed what could be interpreted as UFOs, as objects flying around at extraordinary speeds. The video that I looked at in STS-80 showed similar phenomena, but it also showed an extraordinary event that looked like kind of like you've seen Roman candles, you know, like a flare that shoots out of a Roman candle. Well, this event, a similar thing appears in the space shuttle video several minutes before a segment that, you know, pretty much all the, you know, NASA folks and others had looked at, and, you know, NASA said, well, these are just ice particles, and others on the other side, you know, some of them are believers. They could, you know, look at any video and say, yeah, it's UFO. But a lot of people said, oh yeah, those are definitely flying saucers. And I think, you know, in most cases they were just blurred. You know, the camera, there were objects real close to the camera that appeared blurry. And so, you know, that part of the video was there was really nothing going on there. But if you look a few minutes before that, there's this event that took place that no one ever talked about. In fact, I just did an Ancient Aliens. This is, you know, what, 30 years later, we're just talking about this. I show it on the, I did a little demo to show exactly where this occurred and why it's so extraordinary. Because when you take the imagery that the shuttle, the video images that the shuttle captured, and you map them down to the ground, you can do that with Google Earth. We couldn't do that back in the 90s, but you could do it now. And so you can actually see how far this thing travels in a fraction of a second. And you have an object that looks like a flare from a Roman candle moving at about the speed of a bolt of lightning. It's like, you know, what is this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you say you started this book back in the 1990s. Why did it take so long to complete?
So this is where I was at in the 90s. And I thought these videos were pretty extraordinary, but I started writing a book. I realized, you know, there's not enough here for a book. I don't even know what this means. So I started it and I put it away, and I kind of burned out, if you will, on UFOs, on the Mars investigation, and I got involved in some projects near where I live related to local history and archaeology, and I totally checked out for about 10-15 years. And I actually thought I had permanently checked out of the UFO arena. Mm-hmm. When I started writing Before Atlantis, I was purposely avoiding the whole ancient aliens hypothesis. It was like, or ancient astronauts hypothesis. It's like I wanted to explore the possibility that there could have been civilizations on Earth before man that were descended from earlier, previous subspecies, you know, Denisovans or other unknown human subspecies. And I purposely avoided the whole, you know, ancient astronaut hypothesis. And I figured, you know, I was just sort of done with that in UFOs. And then the Tic Tacs came out, the Tic Tac videos, the DOD released these videos of Tic Tacs, these objects that the Navy pilots were photographing from fighter aircraft, and actually that people in the control center, not just the pilots, but people monitoring them, you know, the attack squadron, the whole, you know, planes and everything on the aircraft carrier, their radars were showing these things were up, you know, up in low Earth orbit, so in outer space, 100 miles up, and they were going from low Earth orbit to, you know, tens of thousands of feet above the surface in a fraction of a second. You know, like mm-hmm. like you could take a laser pointer and, you know, shining it here, and now you're shining it there.
Yeah,
they were moving that fast, and so this, I didn't really know how to process it. Again, because it was the Navy was releasing the data, it's like, okay, we could take the whole conspiracy and hoax angle out, because that's not something I feel that's all counterproductive. I don't want to get involved in the conspiracies and all that stuff. I think it's I mean, other people are doing it, and I'm not particularly interested in it. I think it's you can spend a lot of energy sort of spinning your wheels on it. So again, it was the case that, hey, the government's releasing this data. And it seemed like, you know, people talk about disclosure. It seemed like the government was finally disclosing that that there is some sort of a phenomenon that they don't understand. And it almost seemed like it was like, hey, we don't know what this thing is. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And it seemed like it was a turning point. So I started thinking about the whole problem again, and I realized I had a couple of other cases I had been working on, people had contacted me about that I sort of wrote up and, you know, gave them some slides for conferences and stuff. I really wasn't actively participating. And I looked at all this again, and I thought, well, okay, are there other sightings that corroborate the Tic Tacs? And I found the Jerusalem UFO sighting. And I did an analysis of the video, and I concluded from that that, hey, these objects are moving, they're accelerating just as fast as the Tic Tacs. And this is an object in the Jerusalem UFO videos. There were four observers that videoed an object ascending from a point west of the Old City, moving towards the Temple Mount, hovering, flashing, and then taking off, literally flying out of sight in a fraction of a second. And because, of course, no one could explain it, it's like, well, it's got to be a hoax, right? Well, but if you, you know, do the math and you look at, and you're able to actually do it with some of the videos, actually figure out what the physical distances are, you're getting accelerations that are comparable to what the Navy pilots were measuring.
Whoa.
So it's like, huh, this is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that got that long answer to your question. That kind of got me back into it. I realized that there was something. There is something that is beyond our ability to understand. There's a real mystery out there. It's, you know, people talk about the unknown. The moon is unknown. Mars is unknown. The oceans are unknown. I kind of see that's sort of unknown with a small letter U. This, I think, the UFO and the UAP situation is unknown with a big with a capital U. I think it's the same U that the same capital U that's behind related things having to do with paranormal, near-death experiences, spiritual experience. I think it's a different reality that we're being forced to recognize. Now, we can't explain it as just some other physical phenomenon that's unknown with a little U. It's unknown with a big U because it's, you can't accelerate, you can't explain the phenomenon using any conventional language or framework.
Well, it's, and then of course you're so polite because you're not mentioning any of the people that work in UFOs that can just drive you crazy. Even very kind towards some of these people. And I think that's one of the reasons why it would turn anyone off for a while to get away from UFOs. I know many researchers who have. It's because they become very uncomfortable with all the ifs and the exaggerations, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a very edgy community. I have, like I did after I wrote Before Atlantis, I have a blog and I post research on beforeatlantis.com. And similarly with Not of This World, I have a website and blog, Not of This World, UFO, one word, .com. And I post updated research on that. And when I have a new article, I'll post it on Facebook, half a dozen different groups to get it out there for people to become aware of. And, you know, for the most part, when I post something on ancient mysteries, on some new alignments or some new insights into ages of pyramids or alignments or, you know, something having to do with ancient mysteries, I would say 99% of comments are and feedback is constructive or at least polite or, you know, civilized. And you look at the Facebook pages for various UFO groups, and it's really shocking. There's so little serious critical thought, and very little on some of these sites. Very little decor. They will just they're rude, and it's just very interesting. But still, you know, you got to get the stuff out there. You write a book, and you got to post, and you tell people about it, and you know, a lot of the feedback you get is really not particularly useful. It's not very helpful. It's not very, very thought out. Sometimes people, all they do is they look at the title and a picture, and they make some conclusion about what you've written, and it has absolutely nothing to do about, you know, that.
So. We got a conclusion right now to take a break here on 21st Century Radio with our guest, Dr. Mark Carlotto, PhD. All right, our guest, of course, is Dr. Mark Carlotto, a FUD, an engineer with 40 years experience in satellite imaging and pattern recognition. How does Not of This World differ from your last book, Before Atlantis? I think we talked about it last September.
Yeah. So in Before Atlantis, I started with a completely different premise, I think, than in Not of This World. In Before Atlantis, I wanted to explore the possibility that ancient civilizations, advanced civilizations, could have developed on Earth and have, you know, and have been lost, and that these civilizations could have developed indigenously, in other words, from prior earlier species, subspecies like Denisovans or other species, and so it was sort of a departure from my earlier work on the face on Mars, looking at the possibility of features on Mars having been constructed by extraterrestrials or something of that sort. I took a kind of I went 180 degrees and went in the opposite direction. And I think it's useful to kind of see, based on the evidence, where does that take us without any kind of, as aliens are kind of, because they're so outside the box, it's almost like a deus ex machina in the sense they can kind of swoop in and, they can almost do anything, right? It's almost like the game doesn't have any rules anymore, if that's the case, or at least the game that we're playing in terms of trying to investigate these mysteries. So in Not of This World, I realized that, and this was evolving from looking at the Tic Tacs and other cases, that there really are things that we can't explain. And in fact, we're seeing them every day. It's not, there are stories from the Bible, the wheels of Elijah and Ezekiel and the Book of Enoch and the Watchers, and so many examples of extraordinary phenomena that couldn't be explained in the language of the day. And Eric von Däniken and others interpreted that as well, they must have been ancient aliens, extraterrestrials from another planet. In fact, that's still the theme on the TV series Ancient Aliens. It's still, that's the hammer that, everything out there is an extraterrestrial. That's kind of the direction I started out with in Not of This World, but then I realized there was more to it than that. And specifically, you couldn't really reconcile that whole conclusion with, on the other hand, what SETI people have found or have not found after listening to radio signals for 60 years. There's no radio signals out there. At least none that have been conclusively determined to be artificial or extraterrestrial and of intelligent origin. And so in trying to reconcile the two, it seemed like, if the UFO phenomenon seems to be a real thing, it seems to be something that it's been experienced, reported for thousands of years. People are every day collecting tens, hundreds, probably thousands of cell phone videos of events they can't explain. So it's a real thing, yet there's no radio signals. Why? And so this led me to some analysis I do in the book to conclude that UFOs probably are not extraterrestrial. And so that leads to, not of this world. In the world, in the kind of the Greek sense of the universe, of the physical universe. And that's kind of where that's the direction I'm headed at the end of the book. And I present some preliminary ideas, but it's way beyond my pay grade to, and my education, and I think maybe even the state of knowledge of humankind to know. But I think it's like I said earlier, I think that's the unknown with the capital U. And so it was, Not of This World is 180 degrees away from before Atlantis, and so you got two directions. The truth's got to be somewhere in between.
Yeah, well, that's reasonable and it's logical. Instead of jumping to lots of conclusions, which can drive me crazy every time I go through this with a lot of people who are just getting involved in this over time. Some of the research go back to Hoagland was pretty good, and yet he caused some real difficulties with amongst groups and things of that nature, competing with one another, which I thought was unfortunate. didn't need to happen that way.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times it's human ego. I mean, we all have it, and we all want to be right. We want to be first. We want to, you know, and when, you know, if someone attacks you, you know, or discredits your hypothesis, you take it personally. It's like, you know, I think it's going to take a village to figure this out. It's going to take all of us, you know, working at it in different ways. And, you know, I'm not trying to earn a living doing this. I think as you get older, you have the luxury of maybe working on things that you want to, and approaching things in the way you want to, without being limited to, you know, having to, sort of toe the party line, or, you know, sure, make certain group of people happy. And, of course, other, you know, some people out there are take great joy in getting people upset and becoming controversial, because, hey, right, controversy sells and gets everyone's attention. I'd rather just, you know, I try to approach it objectively and try to offer up some new information, some new insight. It's not totally thought out. This is very organic. You know, I have to say, when I was writing the book, it's like, okay, what am I going to do for a cover? And my daughter's an artist. I have a lot of artists in my family. My wife's an artist, and two daughters are artists, are teachers. And it's like, could you do a cover for my book? And I explained it to Katie. She says, oh yeah, I know exactly what you mean. She came up with the cover of the book. It was like, I don't know how long it took her, probably an hour or two, real quick. And it's like, I love it. And she had taken a high resolution photograph with her cell phone of it. And she said, yeah, Dad, it's just preliminary. I need to work on it some more. But it was very, you know, it's very organic, very sort of, it's emerging. It's very sort of, it's rough. And the more she worked on it, it's like, you know, I think I like the original drawing, original painting. It's an acrylic on canvas. I like the original best.
1 minute before a break, so keep going.
Yeah, and so anyway, so this is her first cut. The other ones, I said, yeah, they're good, but I like the first cut the best. So my daughter did the cover from the book.
Well, it's an interesting, but no, it really is, because I'm trying to figure out of. This very large blue area obviously must be another type of planet. Is that true? And then in the middle you have something that could be a UFO. And, oops, we're out of time. Well, we'll come back a little later on, talk some more about this cover, okay? Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we've been doing this weekly interview for... well, since 1988, I think we're headed towards 40 years, but we may not be on the station for 40 years, I'll tell you that. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Anita Brockington. Now, our guest is, of course, Dr. Mark Carlotto, and we were beginning a discussion on the cover of this book, which Mark's daughter designed. Isn't this true?
Yeah.
Now, this big, large blue curvature there, is that a planet, or is that the sun, or what could that be?
That's an abstracted view of the Earth.
Ah, that's the Earth. Okay. Now, that it seems that there's a rocket ship right in between that and a lunar slice.
Yeah.
And but this rocket ship that you have here is somewhat similar to one of the designs in the book, which I think you – oh, gosh, when I get to that part, there are so many parts of this.
The space shuttle.
Yeah, that's the space shuttle.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, actually, so, yeah, let me explain. At the point – so at when I picked up this recent, you know, within this past year to finish the book, the title at that point was UFOs in space, and it was going to be about the space shuttle videos, because I felt like the space shuttle videos were the best evidence that we had to date at that time of UFOs, again, because of the quality of the data, the source of the data, and so forth. So I said, could you do a cover that has sort of the space shuttle and the Earth and maybe, you know, something that kind of looks like a UFO, mm-hmm. but I wanted to keep it a little, you know, mysterious.
It is mysterious.
And so she did it this way. It's very transparent. And it was actually kind of prescient in the sense that as the book evolved, I realized it wasn't just about UFOs in space. It was about the past tendency to view things as being extraterrestrial maybe was wrong, and maybe these are much more exotic. And then I started thinking about something that's outside of the box, outside of the physical universe, not of this world. And so then, you know, looking at this UFO, it's like, wow, this is transparent. Is it really there? Or is it here? Or is it there? Or where is it? Does it even really exist? And that's kind of how it evolved. But it was this earliest version that she did that I liked, because it's not, she said, well, you know, Dad, I really need to sort of clean this up and that up. And it's like, no, I like it. It's very primal, and it's emerging. And that's kind of the whole sort of tone that I wanted, because this is not totally thought out. This is totally half baked. I mean, most people are thinking about, we've been talking for the last hour about, UFOs being extraterrestrial, being spaceships, being flying saucers, being, you know, beings from another world. Well, maybe that may be part of it. I mean, I think it's a very complicated, very complex phenomenon. But I think it's definitely an aspect that's much more exotic. And that's kind of the direction I think it would be interesting to see where that goes. And hopefully other people will have, you know, other ideas, better ideas, can flesh out some of these concepts better than I can. Physicists. I know there are physicists now that are working on this seriously. There's a group called the Society for UAB Studies. And they're actually studying these videos that have been released by the Navy and actually Department of Homeland Security released a video recently, and the Chilean Navy. These are all, you know, kind of showing similar things, and people, serious scientists, are analyzing them and doing much more in-depth analysis than I'm able to do here. So I think it's some new directions. It's exciting.
Well, I congratulate your daughter, because it looks real. It looks real in the sense that it looks like it's moving. It's not this hard edge. It's a soft edge area, which I think really puts that across. But she probably did that intuitively, which suggests very strongly that she has a good deal of talent from that standpoint. So give her an A+ and $500 and a new car and that kind of thing. Okay. Now, why do you think UFOs, UAPs, are not extraterrestrial? If not extraterrestrial, then what?
Okay, so you mentioned at the beginning of the show how SETI scientists, these are scientists that are interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They've been listening for over 60 years for evidence of radio signals. And they haven't found any. They haven't heard or detected anything that's extraterrestrial that appears to be of intelligent origin. I know there's a lot of controversy. People will disagree with that statement, but think about and the way SETI sort of formulates this whole problem of searching for extraterrestrials is that the universe, or the, let's say, the galaxy, our galaxy, they hold that our galaxy is teeming with life, and some developed a technology, advanced civilizations, and Earth is sort of in the middle, think about the sort of a statistical distribution of technologies out there. Some are more advanced than we are. Some are less advanced. Some may not even use radios. People have said, well, we're not detecting ET radio signals because maybe they don't use radio. Well, true, maybe some of them don't. But according to the principle of mediocrity, which is sort of at the heart of SETI and sort of mainstream science, it assumes that we're not special, we're typical. And so there's going to be civilizations like us, more advanced, less advanced, and so forth. So given that, there should be some civilizations out there that are that have radio, television, cell phones, satellites. And so there should be some electromagnetic signature that we should be able to pick up. Mm-hmm. And we have it. Okay, so we have that on the one hand. So that suggests there's nobody out there. Okay, according to the criteria that SETI lays out, nothing's been detected. The conclusion could be from that, hey, there's nobody out there. Yet, we have this UFO phenomenon, and it's existed for thousands of years. And so what I do in the book, I actually have an article on my blog at notoftheisworldufo.com. It's the article is called, I have it right here. It's called Ancient Aliens from Earth. And what I do in this article is I explain how I use this. It's called the Drake equation that the SETI scientists use to argue that there's some, you know, scientific basis for searching for and finding ETs. I use the Drake equation and I basically do two things with it. I use it first to estimate the number of civilizations out there that are emitting radio waves. I do it sort of in a theoretical way. And I do the same thing for the number of civilizations out there that are spacefaring, that build spacecraft or able to travel interstellar distances. In other words, the whole setup for the whole UFO phenomenon, that there's some number out there that are capable of doing that. And I then show that by using this Drake equation, given the data that we have, no ET radio signals, but yet tons of UFOs, it suggests that it's almost easier to build it's easier to build an interstellar spacecraft than it is a radio or a cell phone, which is, you know, clearly not the case. If you look at technology curves, and I include these in the book, and I kind of explain how, you know, information technology just continues to go up at a exponential rate. Whereas rocket technology, space technology, kind of leveled off. If you think about it, we're going to be going. They're talking about going back to the moon. We're talking about the Chinese and going to the moon to mine helium-3. It's all being done with chemical rockets, you know, liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, methane. Even SpaceX's Starship that they're building now to go to Mars is a chemical rocket. We've had chemical rockets, you know, since, you know, World War II. It hasn't evolved at all. I mean, sure, they're bigger, they're more refined, but we're still using the same fuels. Ion propulsion, nuclear propulsion, all these exotic propulsion, you know, forget about, you know, warp drives. We don't even know what that means. They don't exist even after all these years. So that says that it's a lot harder to build, be a lot harder for us to get out there with our spaceships than to send radio signals out there. Yet SETI has their findings suggest exactly the opposite. So the conclusion is, if UFOs are real, and they appear to be, and there's no signals that have been detected from space, then it's likely that UFOs are not extraterrestrial. They come from somewhere else. And that's what I spend the last part of the book talking about.
Well, before we get to that, what about the possibility of UFOs coming from underwater or being inside the Earth?
Yeah, that's a great question.
So they don't have to be extraterrestrial at all, because it seems that we have had other cultures or other lost civilizations that are extremely old, and a lot is going on, as you well know. And I'm not going to get into the stuff in Antarctica right now, but you know, everyone's so thrilled about that, the possibility.
Right, right.
But there's all kinds of possibilities to make anything up from that standpoint. It's pretty loose.
Yeah. So exactly. So your point is that they could be hiding. I think we're coming up to are we coming up to our the end of this segment?
That's correct. Yes.
You
want to take? We'll take that on the other side. Want to take a break now and do that then?
Yeah, I don't want to get too spun up on an answer.
Got it.
We'll do it on the other side.
Je comprends. In my previous French incarnation, I remember that. Let's take it away. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Dr. Mark Carlotto. And, of course, we're talking about his new book called Not of This World, An Emerging Picture of the UFO Phenomenon, published in 2021. Now, instead of thinking that UFOs have to come from out there, is it possible that there might be beings and extraterrestrials living inside our planet or underwater, especially in some type of submarine of sorts?
So in other words, are they hiding somewhere? Are they hiding in the oceans? Are they hiding on the far side of the moon?
Yeah, probably, because if we knew they were there, we'd probably blow them away. So
well, some say that's why there's a new space race now to get to the moon. Since the Chinese, they sent a probe to the far side of the moon, they're perceived as being ahead of us in some sense. Mm-hmm. We've imaged the moon at extremely high resolutions. Like Mars, and there's the conspiracy folk that say that alien sites are on the moon and on Mars, and they've been airbrushed out and we can't see them. It's been the moon and Mars has been imaged so many times. I think it's highly unlikely that there's something on the surface that that's been hidden. It's like a lie. When you tell a lie, it's extremely hard to maintain it, because you have to fabricate more lies to keep the first lie going. Mm-hmm. And I think after all these years, that'd be really hard to do. So I don't think there's anything on the moon or on Mars, alien bases, if you will. Maybe under the moon there's evidence of these underground caverns and caves, and that's a possibility. And Dr. Bob, you asked about Earth, the oceans. There's so much of the planet, I think 95% of the planet's unexplored. And you mentioned Antarctica. People have been talking about that for years. That could certainly explain some of it. It might explain, bases of operation and so forth. But when something moves at, it's standing still and all of a sudden it accelerates in, a tenth of a second, so that it's out of sight. And it's like a thousand or four, thousands of Gs, tens of Gs will kill a human pilot. How does anyone possibly operate a craft like this? I mean, the accelerations are so high, it would crush any kind of physical instrumentality. Anything physical would be destroyed. So, it's possible that there are unseen places where unknown forces are lurking. I won't rule that out. I mean, because I, again, I believe that this is a very complex phenomenon. But I think there's a part, there's an aspect of this that is unexplained, and it's not hiding on the Earth or on the Moon, in the Earth, in the oceans, but is coming from somewhere else, from, you know, what the, you know, mystics refer to as other planes of existence.
Yes.
And that starts getting really kind of, you know, kind of woo-woo-ish, right? You know, it's like, well, what does that really mean? That's not scientific. But I disagree. I think that's truly at the frontiers of science. You know, the box right now is physical science. If you can't, it's like anything out there, any unknown phenomenon has to be explained within the confines of the box of physical theories, physically based paradigms that, you know, maintain that consciousness is not a primary manifestation, but it's an emergent property of complex physical systems. And, you know, the Big Bang is this theory that the universe started somehow from a singularity, matter was created, and from lifeless matter came life, and from life consciousness. Well, you know, the other view of this from the esoteric traditions is called emanation, which is that in the beginning, it was just pure consciousness, and creation involved the unfolding of universes of increasing densities of matter, decreasing densities of consciousness, you know, from the most conscious down to the least conscious, being the physical realm, where we exist. And so these other realms exist, but we don't have direct access to them, at least physically. We do, perhaps through drug experiences, through meditation, near-death experiences, perhaps paranormal phenomenon also involves some of these realms. So I think, you know, I think there's one equation that explains, you know, the unknown with the big U. And I think all of these are all aspects of it. And so, you know, that I think that's a part of this. So again, going back to, you know, are there alien forces hiding? You know, there may, I'm not ruling out the possibility that there are extraterrestrials, and they're cloaked, they're hidden. We don't know. We know very little about them, or are able to learn very little about them by design. But I think that's only part of it. I think there's a much bigger mystery, and it's really the mystery that's, you know, it's at the core of all the key questions. You know, where do we come from? You know, what is life? You know, why are we here? I think these are the deep questions. And I think the UFO phenomenon is forcing us to face the reality that there are things that we cannot explain.
Yes.
And I think COVID was a game changer. It forced us to look at things differently. And I think acceptance of the UFO phenomenon for what it is at its core, that it's truly something unexplained and beyond physical, beyond the physical universe, forces us to consider, you know, a bigger world. And I think that's, you know, that's what this is all about. And it's forcing us to do that. So you can belittle it, you can marginalize it. But I think this is sort of this is the elephant in the room that scientists can't seem to explain.
Well, they can't ignore it now. That's one of the good things about this situation. Do you think the UFO phenomenon has or will change the world? You sound like it might.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's sort of a tipping point, right? That, you know, COVID was the magnitude of the pandemic, and the effect was so great that it changed institutions, and it changed ways of doing business, ways of communicating, Look at the way, I mean, we, you know, we're Skyping, we use Zoom. You know, these are used much more now. Companies are using them much more, relying perhaps less on having to travel, you know, take, you know, saving. So companies are certainly in favor of this, right? Saves money. You don't have to travel as much. You can use all these technologies. I think, you know, they're transformative, and they've been brought about as a result of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a similarly, I don't know what it would take, maybe just continued exposure to, you know, these sightings and reports are eventually, you know, scientists are going to perhaps crack under the pressure of just, hey, look, you know, there's a mystery out there. We can't keep sweeping this under the rug. We got to really start to try to understand this mm-hmm. when it becomes so obvious. Right. And I think that could, when that happens, that could be a real game changer. It could be a very positive change.
Chapter 2 examines UFO cases. One, clearly a hoax. A second, likely real. And a third, that is unclear. Can we go through those three cases?
Yeah, sure. The first one is quite stunning. When I first saw it, it's like, oh my, yeah, it's like, oh my God, how did they do this? And it was all, it's all done with CGI. It's actually quite incredible. And the more I researched it, the more I learned about all these plugins, in, video production software to, you know, create, shakiness and all sorts of other artifacts. And, so the one that's clearly a hoax is an enormous UFO that's reported, where the heck is it, in
Malaysia?
In Malaysia, Malaysia. Yeah, it's just, it's like, if you saw something like this, you would be like, whoa. It's, you know, it was analyzed. There were a few sources I researched, and I didn't look at it myself, but, you know, it was, the point is that there's some stuff out there on the internet that's quite cleverly done, well done, it's you can determine that it's clearly a hoax. So that's one. So the second was clearly not a hoax, and I think the Gulf Breeze UFO, based on the research largely done by Bruce McAbee.
Yeah.
And there were others as well in the investigation. This is Ed Walters' experiences in Gulf Breeze, Florida, in it's like November 1987 through May 1988. He says in his book, these events have changed my family's and my life forever. No longer can I look at the night sky and disregard the possibilities of intelligent life somewhere else in the heavens. I mean, clearly, he did not do this to make money or for That's fame right. and fortune. And Bruce's analysis of the data supports this, that it's a very very solid set of reports and a lot of photographs, not just one or two, yeah. but quite a few. The little analysis I did, I totally concur with you know what Bruce found. The third case was a researcher in Italy, Marco Baldini of an Italian UFO research group, contacted me and asked me to take a look at some photos of UFOs taken from a town north of Milan, so sort of northwest Italy, and it's intriguing, but my analysis suggests that, you know, and I didn't have access to all the data, but all the UFOs seem to be roughly showing the same lights underneath the same positions. There's some variability. But you know, supposedly all these photos are taken from different locations, and so they should have shown some variation. And then, you know, when you look at, you know, you've taken a cell phone picture at night, right? And, you know, when you take the picture, it's, if it's really dark out, you know, it's really noisy, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot because of, there's not a lot of photons. And so you see what's called the dark current. And in the Lanzada, so this is Lanzada was the small village in Italy where these were taken. The nighttime photos show, you know, a sky with a lot of this dark current, this dark dark current noise, or you know, noise that you would normally see in a cell phone video. But then around the UFO itself, it's just dark. There's no noise at all. And it suggests that, you know, they took a photo and then they inserted, composited a, you know, a picture of a UFO shot in the back black background and sort of like photoshopped it in. So that I would say is probably not legitimate sighting. But, you know, again, without seeing all the data, it's hard to say for sure. And then it was the next chapter. Chapter 3 talks about UFOs near the moon, and this is quite interesting. There was a photo or a video taken by a French Canadian astronomer who took a video of what appeared to be three UFOs flying around the moon from behind the moon across the surface of the moon, disappearing into the shadowed side. And kind of the jury's out on this. A lot of people claim that it's a fake because it shows some indications of being faked, you know, using some of these video techniques. But it's also extremely well done, and there's a lot about it that appears authentic. So it's, you know, some cases are not cut and dry. But when you start talking about the Navy video, the NASA videos, those are, I think, the best evidence. And I talk about those as well and a number of other cases. Crop circles and UFOs, a whole other subject with a lot of back and forth. Again, the SETI people, this whole idea, they just, the idea that there's crop circles, that anyone would, you know, would do this, that extraterrestrials or anyone would do crop circles, is like, they feel it's just kind of ridiculous, and they believe that, you know, all these formations are hoaxed. And, you know, I think a lot of them are, but a lot of them, and there's two cases actually I examined in the book that suggest that at least two cases are authentic. And one shows the formation of a crop circle in a place in Wiltshire in England called Oliver's Castle that's been subject of some controversy for two plus decades. So there's quite a range of cases I look at. And then from that in the book and at the end, I, you know, try to abstract and analyze and come up with some conclusions. So it's laid out pretty simply.
We have a conclusion right now. We have to take a break here. Our final break. Is this true, Dr. Cordner? It is, indeed.
Hi, this is Colonel Gordon Cooper. I'm one of the 7 Mercury astronauts, and I'm listening this evening to Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio.
That's Brother Gordon. Indeed. One of the original 7 Mercury astronauts was asked by a reporter if he pursued UFOs when he was in the Air Force, an Air Force pilot in the 1950s. What did Gordon tell him, Mark?
So, I got to look this up because
Well,
this is like a test. Okay, we have, what's the exact quote here? Basically, he said that they pursued these craft. They were never able to catch up with them.
That's right.
They were always and this is something that, you know, exists today, right? The Navy pilots, again, they tried going after them, and they were gone in a flash. Mm-hmm. There was even, there was another case, the Gemini 7, of a report of a bogey that some say was code word for a UFO. But otherwise, there's really no documented sightings in prior to the space shuttle videos. I wasn't able to find anything. You know, you have Gordon Cooper's comments and a few others off the record, but nothing really substantial to go on. Certainly no photos existed. But then, you know, the shuttle changed that with some extraordinary, I think, extraordinary videos.
Oh, it did. You know, but one of the sections that I enjoyed so much was analyzing the evidence. Would you mind going over that near the end of the book here, which I think our listeners should know about?
Yeah. So, all this new data from the from DOD, the Navy videos, would not have come out were it not for the work of Luis Elizondo, who was head of the ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And there's actually, I think there's two seasons out on, I forget who cares, it's Netflix or HBO. It's called Unexplained, and it's his. Now that since he left the government, he's been, you know, pursuing. He's got a group of people investigating sightings and trying to follow up on what he began to unearth when he was in the government. And he came up with what he called five observables. So what I do is I analyze the evidence, these cases, in terms of the following observables. No visible means of propulsion or flight surfaces, such as wings. The ability to accelerate and change direction quickly, accelerations beyond human tolerances. Hypersonic velocities without physical effects, such as vapor trails and sonic booms. Limited observability, for example, visible in infrared but not in radar, including possibility of cloaking devices. Ability to move within and between different environments, such as space, the Earth's atmosphere, and water. Some of the sightings involved craft going from flying over water to going underwater and out again without apparently changing speed. And, you know, there, as I mentioned earlier, there radar on the Nimitz reported UFOs in low Earth orbit descending to, you know, tens of thousands of feet in fractions of a second. So then what I do is I actually add three additional observables. Do we have a few more minutes?
Yes, we do.
So, expanding on the ability to, expanding on these five, I added the ability to change size and shape.
Now that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Because remember, yes, back in the old days, that's the first things that those who were extremely skeptical would bring up, was that, hey, there's no way that they could just change size and shapes. And that was used by, I've forgotten so many guys in the old days that came out against all this and said, it's just not possible to do that. So therefore, this is a lie. Well,
so
they're wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So this is what I heard Jacques Vallée a little while ago as doing an endorsement for the show. And this is what he says. He says, in many cases, UFOs behave like a hologram that had mass. In other words, if a hologram could also interact with the environment, if it could put holes in the ground and burn the vegetation, you'd have a good approximation of what the UFO is. In other words, it's not an object like that car over there is an object. It looks like a car. It feels like a car, but it isn't a car. It's something totally different, which can look like a car if it wants to. So, this idea of being able to change size and shape. I just posted today a new article on the blog. It's entitled Ongoing Sightings of UAP, and this is over Long Island. This was a few weeks ago, and it's an excellent example of a phenomenon in the sky that seems to split and merge and I don't think anyone can explain what it's doing. And I have some enhancements of it in the article, and hopefully some people will take a look at it and maybe come up with some new ideas. Anyway, so then just to get back to your question, two other observables, associated effects such as nearby disturbances, power interruptions, and others. Now, this is close encounters of the third kind, when Richard Dreyfuss is, in his car and it shuts off. And then the last one is the ability, tendency to appear from out of nowhere and then just disappear, just totally fly out of sight in a split second. So what I do is I examine all these cases in the book, and I have measurements of velocities, accelerations, physical sizes, and then, do they satisfy any of these observables? And so I ask the question, are UFOs a physical phenomenon? Are they beyond current technology? Do they violate the laws of physics? And then, lastly, are they, after talking about SETI, I consider the question, are UFOs extraterrestrial in origin? And I talk a little bit about the politics of SETI and why it's kind of a lot, it's not really, to, it's not, not real science. It's, there's a lot of politics and maybe some might argue a little religion in there.
That's right.
So it's not a level playing field. And then from that, I go on in the last chapter. My last chapter is entitled The New Interpretation, where I use a quote by Viktor Frankl, which is, when we can no longer change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. And I think that's the juncture we're at here.
Well, we are, and this is a very blessed area when you get into this, because when it gets into higher consciousness and how that affects everything is something I think is that others are going to have to check more into rather than avoid these particular areas.
I hope so. Yeah.
Because it will make a very big difference in search of alien, in my opinion, in this particular area. The moon is another possibility. I remember Carl Sagan was one of the first to suggest the idea of alien bases on the moon. That really surprised me. It probably didn't surprise you, huh?
Well, I know. Particularly, towards you look at that and then compare that to what he was saying at the end of his career. He was very, very skeptical, very much mainstream. He was kind of the poster boy for mainstream science,
right.
I never met him. We corresponded a number of times. He actually used some of the data, some of the Mars data on Cosmos. He wanted to include it. And he said it's probably just a rock formation, but if we're going to go there, we might as well take a look anyway. He was, I think he sort of played both sides. I think he was much more curious than he was allowed to be. I think he probably, my guess is that he had to give up a little bit of his autonomy.
Yes.
To be the spokesperson. It's sort of like, as you get older and you don't need to do this for a living, you have your own gig and you can do this on your own, that you can be a little bit more free and pursue, follow the science. And so, because of that, he made that statement. People had been thinking for years about, well, let's see if there's anything on the far side of the moon. And, I don't think we ever talked about this on your show. I published a paper a few years ago about some objects that we did find on the far side of the moon.
Oh.
And the Chinese didn't land all that far from them. But who knows what's going on? Maybe Dick Holden will tell you.
Well, next time he calls, yes, because I keep trying to get back in touch with him, but we seem to fail over the period of time. And I have, I have an enormous respect for him for what he went through. I don't know how he could have controlled himself as well as he did. At times, maybe he didn't do as well as he all times. But the stress that he was put under, he became quite a leader, whether he was right or wrong. unfortunately caused some problems and are never being able to find anything out from NASA, because I'm afraid that when he made certain points, it was embarrassing to them, and I don't think they're ever going to accept that.
Yeah, you know, we sort of, 20 plus years ago, we kind of parted ways because I didn't really want to follow him and follow up on some of the things he was looking at, some of these ideas about glass cities on the moon, and then started getting into conspiracy theories and all that. I totally respect where he's coming from. He's an extremely intelligent guy, he's very creative, yeah. And he's been an important part of the Mars investigation and all these other investigations. I mean, he's added so many important ideas. I people criticize him. He certainly hasn't made a lot of money. No one's made a lot of money doing this. We do this because we care. We're passionate about it.
And that's about it. We have lost. We're up. We're finished right about now. We're out of time. Is that true, Dr. Kortner? We got 35 seconds. What would you like to say in 35 seconds?
So the book is not of this world. You can buy it on Amazon. The website is not of this world, UFO, all one word, .com. It's a blog that has articles, ongoing research. I posted one today titled Ongoing Sightings of UAP over Long Island, New York. These are some sightings from a couple of weeks ago.
Goodbye. Boy.